Preston in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. And good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for joining me. Poland plays an important role in 20th century history, especially for Catholics, because one of the most important devotions of the 20th century emerged there, the Divine Mercy with St. Faustina. Also, we've got, of course, John Paul II, arguably really the titan. People argue whether it's John Paul II or Winston Churchill as the great man of the 20th century. But John Paul II, of course, plays a vital role in the collapse of communism in Europe and his way he encouraged the trade union solidarity. We've got, of course, Edith Stein, who was killed by the Nazis. She plays a vital role in Jewish-Catholic relationships. And, of course, there's Maximilian Kolbe. We're talking about these great figures of 20th century history in Catholic spirituality with Steve Ray, coming up in just a few minutes. Also, you've heard about mindfulness. It's a meditation technique that's gained a great deal of popularity in corporate board offices, in Hollywood, and even in many church settings. What is mindfulness? What is its connection to Buddhist meditation techniques? Is there a Catholic alternative? Is it compatible with Catholicism? We talk it over with Susan Brinkman. We also look at the life of Father Augustine Tolton, the first African-American priest, and we'll talk that over with the man who's playing the role of Father Tolton, Jim Coleman. And then we'll look at the Islamic invention of Jerusalem, the invention of a holy city. Brian Bradford, my guest. But first, let's get to the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, March 21st. It's the Feast of St. Nicholas of Flew. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. Fox News is reporting that the final ISIS stronghold has been liberated and the caliphate has crumbled. Local reporters say a clearing operation is underway and more official announcements are expected soon. Joby Warwick, author of Black Flags, offered his thoughts on the future while on Cresta in the Afternoon this past Tuesday.
It's an interesting crossroads for ISIS as an organization. They've actually been in worse predicaments before, because back at the end of the U.S. involvement in Iraq around 2010, this organization in its previous incarnation was nearly defeated. It was down to a few hundred people scattered in a handful of villages deeply underground. And from that moment, from 2010 to 2013, we saw this remarkable, you know, reflowering, this blossoming of this organization, took up territory the size of Great Britain. So they have been down before, and they've managed to come back. They've seeded themselves around Iraq and Syria and other places around the world to position themselves for a comeback. Whether they can actually pull that off another time is less clear right now.
More than 70 people are feared dead after a crowded ferry sank in the Tigris River in northern Iraq. At least 100 people were believed to be on board when it went down in strong currents near the city of Mosul. Rescue operations are underway, and civil defense officials say there are some survivors. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is condemning the detention of Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido's chief of staff. In a tweet today, Pompeo blamed President Nicolas Maduro's security services for detaining Roberto Marrero and called for his immediate release. The U.S. recognizes Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela and has repeatedly called on the embattled Maduro to step aside. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. St. John Paul II seemed to like March for publishing encyclicals. Coming up on March 25th, he published, Mother of the Redeemer, back, I think it was 1987. And then he published Evangelium Vitae as well on March 25th. I bring this up because one of the great events for Ave Maria Radio in the next year will be visiting Poland. We'll be doing that. Steve Ray will be leading our trip to Poland. And it is incredibly rich with the lives of the saints. Again, 20th century saints. So these are men and women who really breathe the same air that we breathe. St. John Paul II, of course, probably the best known, but you've also got the remarkable media figure, Maximilian Kolbe. Many people don't realize, because of his heroic death, many people don't realize that he was the might say, the biggest, quote, media star in Poland at that period. You've got St. Faustina, and then, of course, you've got the great philosopher Edith Stein, all associated with Poland. Poland is also the place of Auschwitz. In other words, Poland serves one of the most consequential countries of the 20th century. You know, I know people think about this Germany because of Hitler. They think of United States and Soviet Union because of the Cold War. But Poland plays a central role throughout the 20th century because of where it's located, because it served as a buffer between the Soviet Union and Europe, because Hitler had to pass through Poland in order to get his living space, as he called it, on his way to try to vanquish the Soviet Union. It is a country filled with remarkable saints, remarkable history, and I'm looking forward to being there in August with Steve Ray.
I'm looking forward to having you there, Al. You're going to love this. We've done this a number of times, and people are always amazed at how surprised they are by Poland,
yeah.
Not only by the deep spirituality, but by the beauty and the friendliness. And so it's an amazing, and you know, it's amazingly affordable too, more so than other pilgrimages, because I don't know why, that's just the economy is strong.
Allows
there,
you to do that, yeah.
But it allows you to do that. For example, England, to do what we're going to do here would be almost $2,000. Well, $1,500 more. Israel's yeah. $1,000 more. This one is very affordable for
yeah.
people to go
yeah.
to Poland.
So let's talk a little bit about what we're looking at when we go to Poland. It's filled with history, the collapse of the Soviet-style communism. Really, the bomb that goes off is with the trade union solidarity.
Yes,
in
like
Poland,
Valencia.
And the encouragement of John Paul II. What's the history we're touching on there?
Oh, we're going to see a lot of that. We don't get to go up to Gdansk because that's too far up north for the 10 days that we're doing this. But we're going to see a lot. We're going to land in Warsaw. That's
yes.
the capital, of course. And we're going to show people the devastation from World War II and the Soviet time. But also what these amazing Polish people have done since the wall fell, the incredible revival they've had in the whole structure of the cities, the beauty of it, the rebuilding of things, and they're staying strong Catholics. That's
yeah.
what's so amazing to me. The churches are full. I remember when we were in Krakow, we're going to go to a mass with the local people there. But we got there and it was packed. The people were standing outside in the parking lot. Young people. This isn't old people. This isn't a geriatrics parish.
Yeah.
I mean, the churches are full of people and they're vibrant Catholics. And so we arrive in Warsaw and we're going to see a lot of that. Also, we're going to see the walls and the areas from the Nazi times and the Soviet Union. And it's very sobering in a way. But you know what it is? It's very encouraging, too, to walk through this land where you say, this is where the ghetto was, the Warsaw ghetto. Mm-hmm. And this is where the Soviet Union walls were that blocked things. But look at the people. They survived it. Why? Because they held fast to the faith. And it was John Paul II and with Lech Walesa up in Gdansk and Ronald Reagan who brought that wall down. It
yeah.
wasn't the East Germans. It wasn't the Czechoslovakians
right.
or Romanians. Right?
Nope.
It was the Polish people
yep.
that brought that wall down. It's them that brought liberation, and it's because of their Catholicism that did it.
That's exactly right. And again, Cold War historians are very clear
on the role that Poland played, John Paul II.
And especially in Warsaw, we walk through that. I mean, you sense it. You feel there's a big monument to the heroes of that, and we get to go up and take pictures. I mean, I wanted to crawl right in and be one of those guys in this big monument, you know, because I respect them. Even when I was, you know, people used to tell Polak jokes. And I'd always say, don't ever tell them. And this goes back to when I was young, because I realized the courage of these people in their Catholicism. I say, don't ever tell me a Polak joke. You can tell me there was a Soviet who did this one time, but don't ever tell me a joke about a Polak.
Well, Father Jerzy Papiuszko, again, a remarkable hero, the priest to the Trade Union Solidarity who was murdered.
Yep.
And the story is stunning. If you've never heard that story, he is one of the and he was a simple priest too. He wasn't
very
known
simple.
As a brilliant intellectual or something.
He had no intention of becoming a martyr.
No.
Or doing it. He did this because of his love for the Lord and
right.
the people.
There. Yeah, yeah.
And we're gonna the first day we have Mass at his tomb.
Wow.
It's at the St. Stanislav Kostka Church in Warsaw, and we will go there and we'll see his tomb and all pictures like a museum of him and tell the story. People that don't know the story, after this trip, they'll know the story and have celebrated Mass at his tomb.
Very good. Tell us where else we're going to be heading.
Well, one of them, I can't even say this word, Niepokalanov. The Polish words are, there's a lot of whooshes and zwooshes with the language. But this city is, this will be our second day. It's called the Immaculata, the City of the Immaculata. It's dedicated to Mary. And what he did there was built an incredible, with the Franciscans, an incredible media empire there. And it wasn't to make money. He was printing tracts and newspapers and newsletters, and he was publishing. He started the radio broadcasting.
Right.
And
right.
when we're there, we're going to see all his printing presses and his radio stations and all the things he used back then. But he was on the cutting edge of the media.
He was.
And when we're there, the guide, who his name is Alex, and he's a historian and a devout Catholic, and he's brilliant. He will explain to us what Maximilian Kolbe did helped the Polish people survive both the Nazis and the Soviet, because they were so strong in the faith, partly because he disseminated all of these millions of pieces of literature. It made the Polish people educated and strong, so when the totalitarian powers came, they were able to resist.
Yeah. And again, a heroic death as well.
Yep. And I kind of like it that Ave Maria Radio is sponsoring and working with us on this one, because this is one of the heroes of the media right there.
It is. He created a Catholic media empire in Poland, which of course made him vulnerable to the Nazis. So what are we doing with St. Faustina?
Well, we go to the convent where she was, and one of the sisters of her order is going to give us a talk and explain her influence and her life and what they do there at the convent. And that's really quite impressive to have one of her sisters there. But we spend a half a day there, Al, in the convent among the sisters. We will pray the Divine Mercy in the chapel where Maria Faustina prayed it. And we will get to pray that among the sisters and in front of her relics. I have a funny story about that, though. When we were there the last time, I pulled out my iPhone, because obviously I don't speak Polish, and they're all praying. And like I said, it's all, you know, the Polish language is so hard to understand. Well, I pulled out my iPhone so I could follow the prayer, you know, the Divine Mercy.
Yeah.
And this old nun came over to me and she slapped me and says, "No, not here. You don't have this here." And she thought I was doing emails or something, you know. And I said, "Sister, I don't know Polish. This is the Divine Mercy." So I I am so sorry. She said, she pats her cheeks. Oh, I'm so sorry. But that's one of the things we get to do there. We'll spend a half a day going. And they got a great tower you can go up in and kind of have a bird's eye view of the whole area, and but it gives people a real sense of closeness to Sister Maria Faustina and the Divine Mercy, and we'll do talks on that as well about the Divine Mercy while we're there.
Again, Poland plays a central role in the history of the 20th century. Divine Mercy, of course, central to Catholic spirituality, emerges from Poland. You've got St. Edith Stein, who becomes a major figure in the discussion between Judaism and Catholicism in the 20th century, where the relationship was largely mended. You've got the collapse of Soviet-style communism with John Paul II there. And you've got Maximilian Kolbe, who dies a martyr's death in Auschwitz, because he was, again, he held Poland together during a tremendous time of strife. So you, some of the major moments of the 20th century have their origins in Poland.
And it's a remarkable
thing. A lot of people have no idea.
And the whole story of Maximilian Kolbe, that there was a man who was caught for something. I don't remember the exact details off the top of my head here, but he was going to be killed. And Maximilian Kolbe, these guys would stand for hours out in the snow in the cold, yep. and they couldn't go to the yep. bathroom or anything. They'd stand there with the guns aimed at them. And this guy was condemned to die, and Maximilian mm-hmm. Kolbe stepped up and said, "I'll take his place." And they said, "Who are you? I'm a Catholic priest, and I'll die for him." And they did. They put him in a cell and they starved him to death. And later, and it was only not even a whole lot of years ago, maybe 5 years ago, the man who he saved came back to Poland with his whole family to thank, to show his gratitude to John Paul II, or I remember who it was. But he came back, and we're going to tell that story while we're there, too. It's an amazingly moving story of him giving his life for another man.
Let's talk about when this has to happen, because the dates, again, it's August. We begin this August, what's it, August 20th?
Right. And it's really August 21st we leave, and we are really just starting to promote it now and market it. And I would say that if someone wants to go, they should sign up relatively quickly, because our trips are selling out months in advance.
Yeah.
And since this one is only August, we still have a month or two, but I wouldn't wait too long.
Yeah.
I would sign up pretty quick, because this will fill up.
Yeah. One bus is already full.
Yeah, it is. And so, I'm looking forward to having you with us, Al, because you're always making it a pilgrimage exciting and fun to have you along. You and me and Janet, and then we'll have the guide Alex, and we'll have a second guide as well. But this is going to be full of information, full of prayer and masses at the holy sites. It's an incredible trip. You know, just for example, Wadowice is the hometown of John Paul II. We're going to go where he was baptized. You'd be able to go up and renew your baptismal vows in his font where he was baptized, and see where he celebrated his first Mass. And his home has been turned into a museum. We could spend hours in there just looking at pictures you're never going to see anywhere else of him when he was young and when he was a priest and so on. It's a whole wonderful museum that we get to walk through in his hometown.
Breathing the air he breathed.
Yeah, it's really quite amazing. And these Polish people are so proud of him. Oh, you can just sense the pride in this country for that, for their saint, John Paul II.
You can tell the history of the 20th century through Poland.
You really can.
Yeah, and we'll be doing that coming up. How do people get in touch with us on this?
Well, they can go to my website or your website, and they can also call Corporate Travel. What I would do is call them directly at 866-468-1420.
Okay. Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bishop Robert Barron.
Find out, in any cultural situation, who's the Lord? There's somebody or some principle, some figure, some institution that has central importance in that culture. Whether it's king, whether it's the military, who knows what it is? Go up and down the centuries. What's the Lord? The declaration of the Lordship of Jesus will always be a challenge to whatever that reigning Lord happens to be. The Lord today is my personal freedom. I decide what my life is. I decide who I am. I decide everything from my gender to the ultimate meaning of my life. Now that personal freedom is so powerful that it's become the Lord. To evangelize the culture is therefore to challenge them and to say, no, it's not your own ego, not your own freedom that's Lord. Jesus determines the meaning of your life. Jesus is the center of your life, not your own freedom.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Ever wonder why social networking is such a popular internet exercise? We humans are hardwired for society. It's in our DNA. The human person needs to live in society, the Catholic Catechism tells us. It is a requirement of man's nature. There is a certain resemblance between the unity of the three divine persons and the fraternity that humans are to establish among themselves in truth and love. As Jesus made clear, love of God is inseparable from love of neighbor. Humanity's vocation, says the Catechism, is to show forth the image of God and be transformed into the image of the Father's only Son, Jesus. It is through mutual service and dialogue with one another that we develop our potential and thus respond to the end to which we are called, God Himself. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Isn't it awesome that we today do not recognize his presence in the Eucharist? Is it because we really don't go to him in humbleness of heart and say, Lord, I don't believe, help my unbelief. Lord, I want to see you. I want to recognize you. I cannot live without you. Are we saying that?
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. I want to announce that Steve Ray and I will be going on pilgrimage to the great land of Poland, August 21st to August 30th.
We're going to follow John Paul II, Maria Faustina and the Divine Mercy, and Maximilian Kolbe. We're even going to visit Auschwitz and see the place where Maximilian Kolbe gave his life in the cell there.
People can get more information at AveMariaRadio.net. And where else, Steve?
CatholicConvert.com. Click on the big pilgrimage banner or call 866-468-1420.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
The Catholic solution to the healthcare problem is here. Are you fed up with the current healthcare system? Paying too much for your healthcare cost? Solidarity HealthShare is a healthcare sharing ministry which provides an ethical way to fund healthcare costs while protecting and practicing our Catholic beliefs. Best yet, Solidarity HealthShare's members are exempt from the fines and penalties in the Affordable Care Act. Visit SolidarityHealthShare.org to join like-minded Catholics in sharing medical expenses. Traveling for spring break? You don't have to miss your favorite Ave Maria program. Bookmark AveMariaRadio.net or download the Ave Maria Radio app on your smart device. You can listen to more than a dozen live or recorded Ave Maria Radio shows wherever and whenever you want. On the road, in the line at the amusement park, at the beach, or in the evening after a productive day. Stay connected. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. You know, you may have heard and noticed that a word, mindfulness, has become increasingly popular over the last 20 years. It's used, in corporate boardrooms. It's being used as a recommendation by psychologists to help people deal with anxiety. It's actually a word, though, that goes back to an obscure Buddhist meditation technique. And although corporate executives are using it, Hollywood stars are using it, clergy are using it, what the heck is it? What is its relationship to Christian concepts of prayer? Is it compatible with Catholicism? We're going to talk that over with Susan Brinkman. She's the author of A Catholic Guide to Mindfulness. She's a member of the Third Order of Discalced Carmelites, secular. And, again, is the author of A Catholic Guide to Mindfulness. She's done a great deal of work over the years on New Age thought and has worked closely with Women of Grace. Susan, good to have you here. Thanks.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's just start with a definition. What is mindfulness?
Well, mindfulness is actually a psycho-spiritual movement right now, the mindfulness movement. But it's derived from the Buddhist tradition and is the seventh step in the Noble Eightfold Path.
Mm-hmm.
And the Noble Eightfold Path is what Buddhists believe is a process that leads a person to awakening to your true nature. And that seventh step is known as right mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the mindfulness comes from, is from that particular step. And it means controlling your thoughts by maintaining awareness and focus on the present moment, which is usually accomplished through some form of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it is.
Can it be abstracted from the Buddhist context and made a, quote, secular technique?
Good question. Experts have looked at that particular question, and they said that, you know, mindfulness as therapy very definitely overlaps with mindfulness as spirituality. In fact, they have determined that you actually need both for it to be effective.
Really?
You would need to have both of those components in there. Because mindfulness is often learned or practiced in a secular manner, but individuals will come forth and say, but yeah, I got a lot of spiritual benefits from it too. And that goes right along with, as I said, the research, that the two of them definitely overlap.
So
it's difficult to withdraw it.
So
from the Buddhist, from where it's founded.
And Buddhism is often thought to be
a non-theistic religion. Atheists can practice Buddhism, right?
Oh, yeah. They love to say that. There's no God in Buddha. It's a God-free philosophy.
Yeah.
But it's actually, it's very much a belief system, Al. It
right.
definitely is.
Right. Yeah, no, there's no doubt about it. The thing that's troubling here, it seems to me, is the feigned innocence of those who are promoting mindfulness as though somehow it can be disconnected from the Buddhist worldview in which it occurs. And I think that's the most difficult point to get across. People who would not never consider pursuing Buddhism imagine that they can pursue mindfulness without imbibing some Buddhist concepts. So let's, first of all, let me take the position for the sake of discussion here that I don't know what the problem is with mindfulness, Susan. All it means is making myself more aware of the present moment. I think that's how most people think of it, right? It makes me more aware of the present moment. So what's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that.
Okay.
There's nothing wrong with that, Al.
Right.
Of course there's nothing wrong with that. We're supposed to be able to stop and smell the roses.
Yep.
I mean, that's just something that we're supposed to do. But here's what happens with mindfulness. It's the old bait and switch.
Mm-hmm.
They tell you that's all it is. You're just going to learn how to focus on this present moment. All you're going to have to do is just look at what's going on right now and only feel that. You don't have to judge that. You just be aware of what it is. But the way that you do this is through Buddhist meditation techniques. That's how you're taught.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's how they gradually introduce you to that. And it would be breathing space meditation or body scan. Those are the two most popular. What most people don't realize is that those are Buddhist meditation techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not being told to people until they're actually involved in the mindfulness. And that kind of all got blended together by Jon Kabat-Zinn. That's the biomedical scientist that really started this in the West. He was a practicing Buddhist. He believed that his karmic assignment was to find a way to bring his Dharma practice together with his scientific pursuits to create, as he said, this one unified whole. And he was on a Vipassana retreat, and Vipassana is a form of Buddhist meditation. And he had a vision, and he saw a way to do this. And it was through a program that he would later call the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program, or the MBSR. And that program was designed, of course, to be very patient-centered. It could be used in hospitals to treat PTSD, stress, anxiety. But with the core of the program being intensive training in mindfulness meditation, and that was the core of it, he knew that those Buddhist roots were going to make people very nervous, and so he bent over backward to find ways to employ that program without revealing the Buddhist roots. So this is where it all started, with this blending in here. Oh, no, it's not. They kind of hide it. They put it in the background until they get you in there. The therapist will start telling you how you absolutely got to have this, how great it works for everything. It's going to cure you of anything that ever hurt you. I'm being facetious here.
Yeah,
but that's what they do.
Yeah.
And then they say, okay, so now we're going to do this. Now we're going to just sit down with our feet on the floor, and we're going to now focus on our feet. And how do our feet feel on the floor?
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to start to move up to the top of the foot. And then we're going to go through. What they're doing here is called body scan meditation.
Right, right.
That's Buddhist. And these kind of things can lead you into altered states because you become hyper-focused on things. It's almost like with the mantra-based type meditation. You can also do that with the hyper-focus that's in mindfulness, and that puts you in an altered state. So a lot of people get into these situations with the therapist and then find out later they were introduced to Buddhist techniques, and they get very upset about it.
Isn't that funny?
And
I mean,
many professional therapists have written to us and have written about how they feel that's unethical.
Right. Yeah, that's what bothers me
here.
People
to a religious belief.
Yes, I agree. It reminds me a little bit of what was done with TM, Transcendental Meditation, in the 70s and 80s. Again, there was the attempt to introduce it as a secular meditation technique. So this seems like we have another Eastern spirituality that's being divested in its appearance. It's being divested of its Eastern practice and being represented as a secular technique. We saw it with transcendental meditation. Now we're seeing it with mindfulness, one being Hindu, the other being Buddhist.
Right. And you know, mindfulness, by the way, and that's the whole third chapter of the book, because this is what blew my mind as a journalist. All of these so-called studies that back it up,
yeah,
there really is no backing for this right now. In 2014, you know, researchers at Johns Hopkins, they reviewed 19,000 studies on mindfulness and Eastern meditation techniques, and they came up with just 47 that met their criteria for a well-designed study. That's 0.0026%.
Yeah.
That's all. And of the 47 that they found that, you know, that made the cut, the science found only small to moderate effect of mindfulness in reducing emotional symptoms and no evidence that mindfulness programs were better than other treatments. So this is where I really started to get interested in writing a book.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, you know, consumers have to be made aware of this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I agree.
You know, not just Christian, Catholic, but all consumers have to be made aware of this. You know, the science is not behind it. In fact, the same month that my book came out, 15 of the world's top scholars and scientists in psychology and different areas associated with it came out with a statement that said, in essence, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, stop this runaway train. We do not have the science that we need to back mindfulness up for the way it's being presented and really promulgated throughout society. As you were saying, businessmen are doing it. Hey, kids are doing this in school.
Right.
They're introducing this stuff in school to children.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have this backing. It does not have scientific backing. So that's part of the reason why I wrote the book, because I thought, you know, the information's got to get out there. And, of course, from a Christian and a Catholic point of view, because it is associated with Buddhism, and there's a lot of kind of hype surrounding Buddhism that it's compatible with Catholicism.
Right.
That I felt needed to be addressed, too. And I get into that in the book, too, about there are really some very serious differences between the two faiths, and they don't jive.
You know,
they're not compatible.
It seems to me mindfulness in Buddhist meditation technique focuses on detachment, right, from the external world and also from relationships. It's a way of transcending suffering, I suppose, but it's non-relational. And that seems to be just completely contrary to the Christian understanding of prayer, which is intensely relational.
It absolutely is. It's such a good point that you're making. You know, even our idea of love is different between Buddhism and Christianity. With Christians, a very personal, very selfless, agape love. But in Buddhism, it's karma, which is this universal feeling of compassion. And I know I use an excerpt from Dr. Kreft in my book. He uses the analogy of the giving gloves to a beggar on a cold day. The Christian's going to give gloves to the beggar out of love for that beggar. But the Buddhist is going to give it because it's the enlightened thing to do because, hey, I've got two gloves, so why don't I just give him one of mine?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the enlightened thing to do. So it's all about liberating the giver from the burden of self.
Okay.
So there's, everything about Buddhism is concerned with the self. It's not concerned with God. So that's why in prayer, the two would never go together.
Yeah.
Because our whole direction is outward toward God, and theirs is all inward toward themselves and enlightenment.
How did this become popular in certain Catholic circles? Is it Thomas Merton's interest in Eastern thought, and especially towards the end of his life?
Oh, I'm sure that that had something to do with it. And there's been, you know, other Catholic writers out there who have really kind of jumped on the bandwagon.
Mm-hmm.
This mostly the bandwagon of let's embrace Buddhist practices and techniques because they're okay, and Nostra Aetate, you know, the declaration on the relationship of church to non-Christian religions, you know, it says you can adopt what is good, but the church doesn't reject anything that's true and holy in other religions because they often reflect the ray of the truth that's in our religion. So actually what we're doing is we're going to adopt what we see of ours that's in there.
Right, yeah, exactly.
And people kind of mess that up.
Yeah, I agree. Susan, hold it there if you would. We'll come back on the other side of the break and continue conversation. My guest, Susan Brinkman, author most recently, of A Catholic Guide to Mindfulness. I'm Al Cresta. We'll be right back.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo.
Do you want an affordable health care option that enables you to protect your family and live your Catholic faith? CMF Curo is the Catholic health care ministry that works to bring health to the whole person, spirit, mind, and body. CMF Curo allows you to share health costs with other Christians and is more affordable than health insurance. Go to mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com. CMF Curo, healthcare fully alive.
The Catholic University of America and the Institute for Human Ecology invite you to join the third Healing the Breach of Trust Conference on March 26th in our nation's capital. Engage with some of the best Catholic minds in the country, including experts in organizational behavior and journalists presenting competing views of the role of sexuality and of clericalism, and a deeper analysis about the root causes of the Church's crisis. For more information on how to register or access the event via live stream, visit healingthebreach.org. This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. St. John Paul II stated that for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love, and the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation. So we know we're called, but how do we do it? St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Catholic Charities provides aid to 10 million people across the United States. Consider a donor-advised fund with Catholic Charities USA, an effective way to give, realizing senior tax benefits and assuring your investment is used in accordance with Catholic social teaching. Minimal initial contribution is lower than most donor-advised funds. To learn more, go to ccusa.gives/legacy or call 1-833-323-4483.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everything?
Why do I need to confess my sins to
why
a priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to wreck?
The Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are committed.
As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
The radical hard left, which now controls the mainstream Democratic Party, has declared war against conservatives, and in particular, conservative Christians and Jews. The propaganda arm of this assault is the George Soros-funded Southern Poverty Law Center, or SPLC. For years, SPLC has engaged in a political propaganda campaign to malign its political adversaries by falsely labeling them as hate groups. SPLC operates much like Joseph Goebbels' notorious Ministry of Propaganda for the Nazi Party, functioning as purveyors of hate. For SPLC, it has become a very profitable business. It has over $500 million in assets, with over $120 million parked in offshore accounts. As you can see, this enemy of liberty is well-funded, and it seeks to weaponize financial agencies, left-wing government officials, and others against conservative Judeo-Christian values. Make no mistake, SPLC is an enemy of the state. Its business of identity politics and name-calling, the main tactic of the left, is harmful to our nation. It foments violence. It seeks to divide America. It wants nothing less than the institution of a hard-left regime in which conservative Christians and Jews and the values they hold dear are cast aside. Don't be fooled. With the assistance of the Southern Poverty Law Center, the policies of the hard left, which are now becoming mainstream for the Democratic Party, inevitably lead to totalitarianism. But I say, defend liberty. Resist the left, its propaganda, and its so-called progressive policies. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Susan Brinkman, author of A Catholic Guide to Mindfulness. Again, mindfulness, one of those concepts that's become incredibly popular. When was it first introduced, Susan, into, you know, Western thought?
Oh, back into mindfulness, really. The current movement that we're seeing now is back in the 70s and 80s.
Okay. And so I've noticed that the Great Courses series, the teaching company, has now courses on mindfulness as well. And I saw that in Great Britain, they're going to be introducing certain meditation techniques to school children. And I'm certain mindfulness will be one of them that they're going to be introducing there. Is it, when we talk about mindfulness as a meditation technique, you mentioned body scan is one particular technique. Are there other types of mindfulness techniques that are used?
Yeah, there's moving. Okay. Moving mindfulness, that where you move parts of the body. It's almost like you would go through a yoga.
Yes.
Routine. Okay. In fact, yoga is part of the mindfulness-based stress reduction program. That's a part of that program. And then you focus very hyper-focused, again, on the different movements that you're making. Of course, breathing scan meditation is probably the most basic of them. That was the one that the Buddha himself used.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just focusing on the breathing, breathing in and breathing out, mm-hmm. and just keep staying on that. So, yeah, there are different kinds. Vipassana would be just a much deeper version of that. Much deeper version of mindfulness would be the Vipassana. And it's very popular out there. Very popular, these Buddhist meditation techniques.
Mm-hmm.
As far as retreats, these 10 and 11-day retreats, we just had actually a very tragic thing happen here maybe a year ago now in Pennsylvania, where a young woman went to a Vipassana retreat, 11 days of meditation for 10 and 11 hours. Imagine that, sitting in that altered state for 10 or 11 hours a day. And she, of course, had a complete mental breakdown and ended up committing suicide after that. That's the other thing about this that's a lot of experts are very upset about, and that is that they never report the negative findings about the practice of mindfulness and the fact that there's even too few studies that are bothering to look for it.
For the negative,
And I know at Brown University, Willoughby Britton is one of the doctors that is looking into that now, and she does have quite a bit out there. It tells you the physical, psychological, physical side effects, depersonalization, psychosis, hallucinations, feelings of anxiety, insomnia. This happens, and it's not isolated. One study found that 63% of the group that was studied had suffered at least one negative effect from that kind of meditation. You can't just sit in an altered state all day.
I was just going to say.
You can't leave your mind like that.
Right. So there's something unnatural about this withdrawal from the external world and withdrawal from human relations. That's the way it strikes me. Is that a proper way of putting it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it becomes very dry and impersonal. And I don't know if you've ever heard of this new app that's out now called Halo. But I know that I talked to the founder of that new app, and it's all Christian meditation now that he focuses on. And that was his experience. He was into Headspace and Calm and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And he was using those in this Eastern meditation. He said, it was just so empty. It was just so full of me.
Yeah, yeah.
And, he wanted God. He was looking for God. And it's like God's not there if you're just sitting there gazing at your navel all day.
Right.
And that's very New Agey type. And that's why the New Age adopts Buddhism and these Eastern techniques, because they just endorse all that.
Yeah.
They endorse all that enlightenment and the quest to find your inner divinity.
Right.
This is very much a part of the New Age, and it's also very much a part of Eastern religions, because they're both pantheistic.
Yeah,
so,
that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is, it's amazing. I'm just amazed to see this come around again. Late 60s, early 70s, you begin to see this preoccupation with Eastern spirituality. It's the cool thing to do. And then you have, some reaction to it in the 80s. People finally start publishing on it and seeing through it. But here we have a kind of a newer manifestation of it. And this time it's not getting quite the resistance that I think it did, 30 years ago now. So let me come back to this, and I like the book because you take seriously the fact that people do hunger for God, that there is that oftentimes people get involved in these mindfulness techniques or even other types of alternative spiritualities because they do want to know God. So let's talk about alternatives to mindfulness. Somebody wants, says, I want to, my life is empty, I'm too busy, I'm being tossed back and forth by all the different obligations in my life. I'm overwhelmed. I need to find a new center, so to speak. What do we offer?
Oh, we've had this for hundreds and hundreds of years, Al. Sacrament of the present moment.
Yep.
That's something that's put forth by Father J.P. de Caussade, a Jesuit. He was one of the greatest spiritual directors in the history of our church. And he teaches that, you know, we have to learn how to sit still and let God come to us in whatever way he wants to in each moment of our day and in every moment of that day. So our attention always has to remain focused on things as they are occurring, on the present moment. We've mm-hmm. got to stay in the present moment, minute by minute, because that's how God speaks to us. He speaks to us in the moment. And we know that we have, that our God is a God of the present.
Yes. Yep.
You know, and this is where he is. He's right here in this moment right now. And all the graces we need for this moment are right here with us right now. So we want to stay in that present moment. And you do that, of course, by practicing the presence of God. So those two, and that was put forth by Brother Lawrence of the Resurrection, those two go together, and they make the perfect alternative to mindfulness for a Christian. And if you can learn to live that way, staying in that present moment, you can plan. You have to be able to plan out things. But there's no anxiety in it.
Right.
You plan it, and then you leave it there. Mm-hmm. You leave it in there, that future, and you come back to the present. And you reside there with your Lord in that present moment. And when you get into that and really start to live it out, it's like being in a zone. I call it the zone. you're just like moving along. Mm-hmm. You get an incredible amount of work done. I don't know how he does it, but you get an incredible amount of work done because you're very focused on what you're doing at that moment, and you're confident because you're with him.
Yes.
And you know that what you're going to need is here.
And you're offering it back to him as an offering. It's a gift that you're offering back to God. You're offering his gift back to him, which you can do in the present moment.
Exactly. It's a gift of love. It's like saying, I'm so happy to live my life with you, Lord.
Yeah.
Let's live every minute of it together. I mean, it's just the perfect little, you know, exchange of love between you and your Lord, and you can do that every moment of the day. But you've got to stay focused on the present moment. And we know what? We really don't do that.
No.
We like to rush ahead into the future, the what if this happened, what if that happened, you know, all this, you know, anxious forethought. Or we're dwelling in the past, what happened to me before, and da-da-da. We just don't tend to be in that present moment. A good exercise to do would be to sit down, if you have a few minutes one day, and just write down, okay, where were my thoughts in the course of this day? How many of my thoughts were angry? How many were positive?
Mm-hmm.
How many were sad?
Mm-hmm.
How many were anxious? How much of my thought, what percent of my thought, you know, was happy?
Yeah.
And really, you can sit there and take an inventory. I call it the thought inventory. And you sit down and you look at that and you say to yourself, now, wait a minute. Why are most of my thoughts angry?
Right.
I need to get to the bottom of this. I need to take this to the Lord in prayer and say, Lord, what's sparking all this anger in me? Where am I at? Or if you're anxious or whatever. And you can take it to him and he starts to work you through that so that you can get yourself back into that present moment, which is with him. So you're with eternal joy. And Brother Lawrence used to say, you know, when he was writing about this in his book, Practice of the Presence of God, he would have so much joy sometimes that he would do foolish things because he didn't know how to contain it. And he kept waiting for the crosses to come.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you tricked me, Lord. I don't have any crosses. But he did have crosses. And you know what, Al? He had so much joy that he really didn't notice.
He didn't notice them.
How bad it was, you know?
Yeah.
And that's how it is when you're with him in that present moment. No matter what happens to you, he's right there with you. And it just gives you confidence. Even just subconsciously, you're just very confident because you know he's there and he'll give you the grace you need for that moment.
Why do you?
There is no substitute. This is no substitute, really. Mindfulness, no way. It doesn't even come close to what we have.
I agree. And I'm wondering why you think, and this takes you a little bit beyond the scope of the book, but I'm interested to know why you think that these more traditional spiritual disciplines are not taught regularly. At the parish level?
You know, that's a very good question because I myself, being a Carmelite, I do teach it, and I teach it in parishes here in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. I teach Carmelite spirituality, which is, you know, Catholic mysticism.
Right.
And people are just like goo-goo-eyed. They just sit there like, what? You know, they never heard of it before. And it's because nobody really teaches it. When was the last time you heard anyone preach on prayer?
Yeah.
And how to pray?
Yeah. Well,
Catholics think that the way you pray is the rosary and the mass. They have no idea that there's so much more to prayer.
Yeah. Well, my pastor is in fact, my pastor is in fact is a Carmelite, so we do.
Oh, we're so lucky.
We do hear about it, but yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't see why we don't hear more. Is it because most priests believe that it's asking too much of Catholics?
I don't know. I'm not sure why it's not mentioned that much in church, or why we don't bring in people who teach it, who can teach Catholicism. You know, you have people coming in there and they're teaching all this, you know, mindfulness stuff in Paris.
Yeah,
they're teaching
I know.
This. But you couldn't get Theresian spirituality in there to save your life.
Right.
And it's like, why not? And one of the reasons I think, truly, and it sounds overly simplistic, but is that we're just not in vogue. Right now, we're just not the trendy thing.
Right,
and you look at these retreat centers; almost none of them preach Christ anymore. They're all into Tai Chi and yoga and all this. I mean, try to find something in the schedule that says, you know, Jesus, our Redeemer and our Savior, or how about the practice of the presence of God once in a while?
Right.
Why don't we do that if you want mindfulness? So, it's just not in vogue right now. It's just not trendy. It's not where the money is. I mean, that sounds terrible, but you know what? These retreat centers are trying to stay in business.
Sure.
And we have a population right now in this country that's becoming increasingly secularized.
Yep.
And what people don't realize is that we're both body and soul. And if you're just going to be sitting in your secular world, feeding your body, your spirit's going to get starved, and you're going to go out there looking for whatever food you can find.
That's right. That's right.
And fall into traps.
Susan, thank you for being with me. This is a very, very helpful book. And let's talk again, all right?
I will love to. I look forward to it.
Okay. Susan Brinkman, it's called A Catholic Guide to Mindfulness. Of course, we'll have it available to you in the bookstore. I'm Al Kresta.
This show is underwritten in part by the following nonprofit company.
Wow, Pro-Life Across America is celebrating its 30th year of saving babies.
That's right. Hello, my name is Marianne Koharski. I'm the director of Pro-Life Across America. We began 3 decades ago, and thanks to our supporters, we now have billboards, radio ads, and internet ads across the country.
So what have we learned in these 30 years?
No woman wants an abortion. Most feel panic, pressure, and alone. Our hotline receives an average of 200 to 250 calls a month. We connect callers with free, confidential, and life-affirming assistance.
Please help continue this legacy of support or post-abortion assistance. Visit us at ProLifeAcrossAmerica.org. Or to donate today, simply press #250 on your cell phone and say the keywords pro-life. Pro-Life Across America, non-political and totally educational. Pro-Life Across America,
the billboard people. Dr. Ray Guarendi.
If I discipline consistently, I'd be disciplining constantly. If I were consistent in my discipline, that would mean I would discipline more, and I'd be disciplining him often. The exact opposite is the case. More consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. Why? Because you're predictable. The child knows if he does A, you'll do B. That is why, when you are predictable in your authority, you will actually have to use that authority less. Consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. The more you act when you need to act, the less you will have to act in the future with similar misbehavior.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Kresta. To learn more about our upcoming trip to Poland and looking at the tremendous sites associated with John Paul II, St. Faustina, St. Maximilian Kolbe, and St. Edith Stein, Take a look at AveMariaRadio.net, the website. There we have a way for you to sign up to join us on our trip and pilgrimage to Poland. The Catholic Guide to Mindfulness is available in the online bookstore. Also check the EWTN Religious Catalog. Again, it's called The Catholic Guide to Mindfulness by Susan Brinkman. Now, coming up next hour, we're going to be taking a look at one of those remarkable lives that's often forgotten. It's a late 19th century life. It's the life of Father Augustine Tolton, the first African-American priest, and he's on track for sainthood. His life is now being presented in a St. Luke Productions show. So we want to make sure that you have access to this. I know in Southeast Michigan, we've got a number of dates coming up at the end of March and the beginning of April, but you can find performances all around the country. Father Augustus Tolton, our topic in the second hour, and also Islamic Jerusalem, the invention of a holy city. Dr. Brian Bradford will be my guest. You know, people, you may not realize the importance of this that particular topic, but we know that, for instance, with Judaism, Jerusalem plays a vital role. It's there are a number of reasons, chief of which, though, it's the city of David. So the monarchy in the history of Judaism is an important phase of its history. So there's no doubt that Jerusalem is connected to Judaism. There's no doubt that Jerusalem is deeply connected to Christianity because of the life of Jesus and because of the crucifixion, the resurrection, the ascension, the first preaching in on Pentecost. History is vital to Judaism and Christianity. And Jerusalem, as an historical city, is the site for the great moments in salvation history. That is not true with Islam. Islam basically invented its concept of Jerusalem. We're going to talk that over with Dr. Brian Bradford. So stay with me.
More coming up. This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The Church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. Well, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. We have something to talk about, a little bit out of the ordinary. Jerusalem. Islamic Jerusalem. It's an invention. We're going to talk that over with Islamic scholar Dr. Brian Bradford. Jerusalem plays a vital role historically, I want to stress, historically in Judaism and Christianity. It doesn't play a vital role in the history of Islam. So why has Islam built in Jerusalem? We're going to find out why with Dr. Brian Bradford. Also coming up, we're going to look at the life of Father Augustus Tolton, who is now one step closer to being the first Black American saint. A Vatican committee has unanimously voted to send the sainthood cause of Father Augustus Tolton to the next stage. Tolton, a former runaway slave, the first African American priest in the United States, he was born into slavery in Missouri in 1854. Escaped to Quincy, Illinois with his family during the Civil War. His dad, in fact, died fighting in the Civil War. He studied for the priesthood in Rome because no American seminary would accept him on account of his race. And then was ordained in 1889, served for 3 years at a parish in Quincy. and eventually accepted an invitation to come to Chicago, where he led the St. Monica Parish until his death in 1897. So it is a remarkable life, but a short life. And the Theological Commission, a 9-member Theological Commission at the Vatican, voted unanimously on February 5th that Tolton's sainthood cause, which began in 2010, should be moved forward and presented to the ordinary meeting of cardinals and archbishops. This is being conducted by the Archdiocese of Chicago, I should say. So the members are going to take a final vote before they present a decree of heroic virtues to Pope Francis for approval. So we've got something happening in the life of Father Augustus Tolton. We're going to talk it over this hour. But first, we're going to get today's headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, March 21st. It's the Feast of St. Nicholas of Flu. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. President Trump says it's time for the United States to fully recognize Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights.
I've been thinking about doing it for a long time. It's been a very hard decision for every president. No president has done it.
The Golan Heights was captured from Syria by Israel during the 1967 Middle East War. Israel annexed the territory, but the move was never recognized by the international community. Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu had a chilly relationship with President Obama, but appears to be much closer to Donald Trump. New Zealand's prime minister says the country is banning the sale of military-style semi-automatic rifles and assault rifles following last week's deadly mosque massacres. NBC's Keir Simmons breaks down this proposed legislation and how it will move forward.
The new law will take effect in just 3 weeks and includes a buyback scheme that could cost the country $138 million. But there's widespread and bipartisan support.
A gunman armed with assault rifles opened fire at two mosques in Christchurch last Friday, killing 50 people and injuring dozens of others. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says the attack changed the country's history forever, and the law will have to change too. Today is World Down Syndrome Day, and MIT is receiving a donation of more than $28 million to create a new center to study Down syndrome. The funding comes from the Atlanta Foundation, which is run by a wealthy couple from Brazil with a daughter that has Down syndrome. MIT officials say this is one of the largest gifts ever donated to study Down syndrome, which affects one in every 700 children born in the U.S. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Father Augustus Tolton was the first African-American priest publicly known to be black. He's on track for sainthood. And in the last year, we have a Deacon Harold Burke Sievers who's written a brief biography and also extracted from Father Tolton's life lessons for us all. It's simply called Father Augustus Tolton. Again, by Deacon Harold Burke Sievers. And also, we have St. Luke Productions, who has produced a production called Father Tolton. And it stars Jim Coleman. Jim has served as a medic in the U.S. Army before he became an actor. He's appeared in more than 50 national commercials, probably best known for his role of Roger Parker in the hit Nickelodeon show My Brother and Me. And it's good to have you make your acquaintance, Jim. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about Father Augustus here. This is a man slated for sainthood who, being formally recognized as a saint, that I think a lot of American Catholics are unfamiliar with. Give me his dates to begin with. When was he born?
Father Tolton, he died in 1894.
Okay.
He was born in 1854. He died in 1897, actually.
Yeah, so I mean, fairly young, though.
Yeah, he was 43 years old.
Yeah, yeah. What were the circumstances that he grew up in?
Well, he was born into slavery in Bush Creek, Missouri. At 8 years old, he, his mother, and two siblings escaped by some soldiers, Union soldiers, actually put him on a little rowboat and pushed him out into the Mississippi and allowed them to row to freedom into Illinois. And he was 8 years old at the time. They got to Quincy, Illinois, And his mother sought out the Catholic Church to try and get him an education. He was accepted initially into one of the St. Boniface Catholic Church in Quincy, but he was quickly kicked out because of his race. And then he went to public school. But he eventually did go to Catholic school with Father Peter McGeer, who allowed him into his school. And but no seminary in America would take him. And he ended up going to Rome and becoming a priest there after studying for 6 years.
I think people find it revolting to think that even a Catholic seminary in the United States wouldn't take him at that
right.
time. I mean, given the Catholic Church is recognized then and now as a universal institution, we're not tied to, not like the Church of England or something like that. And the thought that our church would be tied to local racist norms, it's a little difficult to understand. How was that justified? How was that justified?
It's America, and you really don't have to justify.
You don't have to. It's in the air.
This is America. We don't want you, and you can't come in. That's it. Yeah. You're black. You're not allowed. That's it. And nobody's going to really question it. Someone may be a little annoyed or upset by it, but that was the time. That's just the way it was at that time in America. And, I mean, to some degree, it's still that way in America. If you're not liked, you're just not liked. People can say, we don't want you.
How did this impact? I mean, he's aspiring to be a priest. He's assuming he's going to be accepted. What happens when he's rejected? What does he go through spiritually?
Well, when he's rejected, I think it's more than anything else. As an individual, you give up. You just say, it's not going to work. I'll just continue to work at a tobacco factory or wherever I can to take care of my family. But when you have the love and support of a strong mother, which he did, she continued to push it. And he had the support of a white Irish priest, Father Peter McGeer, who continued to push him. And sometimes even when we give up, if we have that support from others that tell us that you can continue and just believe in God and God will get you to that next level, mm-hmm. with that belief and that support, he continued.
Again, he had a relatively short life. Once he was ordained, was it smooth sailing or did he have difficulty even in priesthood?
Oh, absolutely. Initially, it appeared to be smooth sailing. When he returned he initially thought he was going to be a missionary in Africa. He really didn't want to come back to the U.S. because he knew of the persecution that he had faced while he was here. So to go to Africa where there were people of color like him, he would fit in and there would be no problem. So that's what he thought he would do. But he was sent back to America, where initially he was accepted. It was beautiful. He became the priest at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Quincy, Illinois. But because of his dynamic style of speaking and his just, no one had seen a priest like him that had gone to Rome and come back, could speak 5-6 different languages and was eloquent and could sing, that the parishioners from not just the other Catholic churches, the white Catholic churches, from the Protestant churches, Baptist, everybody came to see him speak.
Wow.
So the priest and the pastors and everybody there became annoyed with him and said, no, you can't do that. You can only preach to the black Catholics. Otherwise, you got to get out of here.
Wow.
So they actually ran him out of Quincy.
Wow. So where does he go from there?
So many blacks that had escaped slavery, that they needed a priest, they needed a shepherd, they needed someone to take care of them. And the diocese basically accepted him in Chicago, and he started his own church there. They started to build it, and I don't think it was ever finished.
Okay.
But they were in the basement of St. Mary's Church there in Chicago, and then he started his own. But shortly thereafter, he died.
Wow. Did he die thinking he was a failure?
I believe he did. I truly believe that no matter how successful he was, how many people he brought into the fold, how many people he brought home, because so many people had given up, black people had given up on the Catholic Church because they weren't welcome. And he let them know that they were welcome, that the Catholic Church was a church for all people.
Yeah.
And even though he didn't finish or build the cathedral that he wanted, like the ones he saw in Europe, he felt that he hadn't done enough. But the fact of the matter is, he did do enough. He continued and he pushed forward. And although nobody talked about his story, or we hadn't heard about his story, now that his story is coming out, we realize that, yeah, he did a lot. He did enough. And he is definitely a central figure in American history.
Do we know why his mother thought that the Catholic Church was a plausible option for him?
Well, that was growing up being a slave. The slave owners, from my understanding, were Catholic. So that is the religion that they put upon their slaves.
Yes.
So that's the religion she knew about. So therefore, when she got there, she just sought out the Catholic Church because she knew that's where God was.
Right. Gotcha. What happened? What about his father?
His father escaped early and joined the military, the Civil War.
Yeah.
And it's assumed that he died during the war.
During the war. Okay. I'd like to know, if you know, when the Catholic Church in the United States formally began creating like a Black Catholic Congress or something, or, you know, when they actually realized they had to do something institutionally to promote Black Catholic priests.
I'm not sure when the Black Catholic Congress actually started. One of the things is that I know, as far as Father Tolton, it was Bishop Perry in Chicago. I think it started around 2010 when they really started to promote him.
Mm-hmm.
And just recently, as recent as February 5th of this year, I think he's moving toward becoming venerable. The degree of heroic virtues should be. I think we're, pretty soon.
Yeah.
We'll be looking at having Father Tolton as a saint, but I'm not sure when the first Black Catholic Congress began.
Yeah. How are you enjoying the role?
It is by far one of the best roles I've ever had. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been in tons of movies and TV shows but all of those roles were basically created by a writer, and I was able to take creative control, creative license, and portray it the way I felt it needed to be portrayed. Mm-hmm. This role, it is a true-to-life story, and I have to try and stay as historically close as possible to the letters that he wrote, to the letters that were written to him, to the history that I was given on his life. And therefore, a lot of times before the show, I pray, and I talk to Father Tolton on a regular basis, and I ask that he tell his story and just allow me to be the vessel that the story it comes out of.
Wow.
And I lose myself in it quite often because I truly feel that he is there telling his story, and it's amazing to go on stage and lose control because the spirit of Father Tolton basically takes over and tells the story.
Are you on the road often with this production? I know you're coming to Southeast Michigan Friday, March 29th, Saturday, March 30th, April 1st, April 2nd. You're going to leave.
Yes.
And so are you doing this regularly then? You're on the road quite a bit?
Yes, I've been on the road doing the show for a year now. I started in January of 2018 is when I began. And it has been just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful experience. And we'll be in Detroit on the 29th and 30th.
Yeah.
We will be at Sacred Heart Major Seminary.
Yeah, that's a great place. Yeah, that's Friday, March 29th, 12:30 in the afternoon, and then Saturday, 2 in the afternoon, March 30th, Sacred Heart Major Seminary. We will have that posted for you on the website at AveMariaRadio.net. And then you're also, I've got it here anyways, at Davidson Middle School in Southgate, Michigan.
Southgate.
Yeah.
That's on the 1st and 2nd.
Yeah.
I think the show on the 2nd is a school show, but the one on the 1st is at 7 p.m., so it's a show for the public. And, I mean, I urge people to come out. What I would love to see is young Catholics, 25 to 45 mm-hmm. to get a chance to see and understand the history.
Yes.
Usually we get an older Catholics come out. People come out because a lot of people think, oh, we're just going out to see this little church show. But I can assure you that this rivals any show you've seen on Broadway.
Very good. Well, we're going to be promoting it. So stay in touch. Jim, we want to make sure that we do everything we can to turn people out. So thanks so much. And we'll stay in touch.
Thank you very much.
Jim Coleman is playing the role of Father Augustus Tolton in Tolton From Slave to Priest. I'm Al Cresta. More coming up.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
Sports, lessons, classes. Can you guess the best activity for kids to sign up for? It's family life. Extracurricular activities are nice, but not nearly as necessary as time with mom, dad, and siblings. Research shows that parents who prioritize regular time to work, play, talk, and pray together, emphasizing simple activities like family meals, family chores, a regular family prayer time, game nights, family days out, have happier, better behaved, more well-adjusted kids than parents who sacrifice daily family time to various activities. Don't let the village raise your kids. Step up and reclaim your family life. For tons of great ideas on family rituals, check out my book, Discovering God Together, The Catholic Guide to Raising Faithful Kids. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Imagine you're writing out a list of the qualities of love. Which quality would you put first? Love is nice. Love is sweet. Love is loving. Well, St. Paul sat down in Ephesus around 53 AD, and he wrote such a list to his fellow Christians in Corinth. Inspired by the Holy Spirit, Paul started his list with perhaps an unusual word choice. He wrote, "Love is patient." Ever wonder why? How about the number of times per day you run into some obstacle, some difficulty or challenge? Isn't life just one long series of frustrations? Without practicing patience, you and I are going to be awfully annoyed, not to mention annoying to others. Many Christians are eager to die a glorious martyr's death, but look out if someone cuts them off in traffic. Love is patient, and God is a genius. This is Patrick Coffin of PatrickCoffin.media. Be a saint. What else is there?
I might have gone to church, you know, at Christmas time, gradually quit going. It's not as scary as I thought it was. It's a much more warm and open place, and God really is about love. It's not about the rules and the things that I remember as a young child. It really is about the love that God has for each one of us that's so deep and wonderful.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church for any reason, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
The Catholic University of America and the Institute for Human Ecology invite you to join the third Healing the Breach of Trust Conference on March 26th in our nation's capital. Engage with some of the best Catholic minds in the country, including experts in organizational behavior and journalists presenting competing views of the role of sexuality and of clericalism, and a deeper analysis about the root causes of the Church's crisis. For more information on how to register or access the event via live stream, visit healingthebreach.org.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Would you get on a plane that doesn't have a pilot? Investing in passive index mutual funds may present the same issue. The Ave Maria mutual funds are actively managed by seasoned investment professionals to help you meet your investment goals in a morally responsible way. Ave Maria funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors could invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. You can learn more about the Ave Maria mutual funds at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
And good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Jerusalem plays a central role in the Jewish faith, certainly in Christianity, and also in Islam. Most of us growing up in the Western world have some grasp of why Jerusalem is important to Jews, why it's important to Christians. But why is it important to Muslims? Historically, how did Muslims come to pray in the direction of Jerusalem? How did they come to believe in what's called Muhammad's night ride? How did they come to believe in the ascension of Muhammad? My guest, Dr. Brian Bradford, is the author of Islamic Jerusalem, Invention of a Holy City. He studied archaeology in Israel, earned his master's in history from Central Michigan University, and subsequently completed doctoral studies at Western Michigan University under our friend Dr. Paul Meyer. He has extensive teaching experience in ancient and medieval history. He's lectured in comparative religion and has focused on Islam, its teaching, and its history. And, Brian, it's good to have you back here. Thanks.
Hi, Al. Great to be back, too.
When you go to Jerusalem today, one of the things that stands out is the Dome of the Rock, which sits there above the temple. The foundation of the Jewish temple. I guess a lot of people wonder, what the heck is a Muslim site doing there? So why don't we just begin by asking, why is Jerusalem considered the third holiest city in Islam behind Mecca and Medina? I mean, was it central to Muhammad's teaching in the Quran? Where's Jerusalem? How's it even originate? Because they didn't have it. There was no Bible, right? There was no Bible in Arabic at the time of Muhammad's experience.
Mm-hmm.
So how does Jerusalem even come to play a part in the history of Islam?
Well, for two reasons. A lot of people, primarily in our Western religious traditions, don't understand that Jerusalem was actually the first city, the first direction of prayer where Muslims faced. It was not Mecca.
Interesting.
This only lasted from about, I mean, this is according to the Islamic sources, this only lasted anywhere from 10 to 17 months. And then Muhammad had a very timely revelation that told him, well, don't look that way. Face the Holy Mosque in Mecca, because it doesn't look like the Jews are going to follow you.
Interesting. So,
and the second reason, go ahead.
Yeah, so I was going to say, so the praying in the direction of Jerusalem was originally some sort of concession to the Jews that he was trying to reach?
Yes, when he leaves Mecca and he goes up to the city of Medina, which was a primarily Jewish city at the time, to get the Jews on his side and to kind of, I hate to use the word trick them, but try to get them on his side as being in the line of the biblical prophets, he prayed towards Jerusalem with them.
Interesting. Okay.
But that didn't quite work out. And as I said, he had a revelation come down, Quran, I think it's chapter 2, that says, whenever you turn your face, turn towards the Great Mosque and don't let the people of the book fool you. Even if they had the information, they wouldn't do it. So just turn towards Mecca.
Hmm. So originally this was a concession to try to reach the people of the book.
Yes.
Interesting. So he had a missionary strategy of some sort.
Yes, initially. Yep.
What other things did he do in order to try to persuade the Jewish people that he was a legitimate prophet in their tradition?
Well, from the sources we have, he tried to get revelations that were concise and seemed to follow or reflect what the biblical tradition, the Jewish tradition, was saying historically. And after not meeting any of these requirements, unable to perform any miracles, unable to predict anything in the future, the Jewish community realized that he probably wasn't fitting in the line of prophets that he said he was.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So they didn't buy his story. So then he begins urging people to pray to in the direction of Mecca. Is that what happens right. next?
Well, that happens around, most scholars date this change to about the year 624. Okay. And, I mean, these are coming from later Islamic sources. Remember, Muhammad dies about the year 632, but there's not really a written literary tradition in Islam until about the year 900, give or take. So there's a lot of time to fill in the gaps and rewrite history and try to go back and do a revisionist look at what was actually happening.
Gotcha. So right now, if that's originally they had an interest in Jerusalem, they turned from Jerusalem. How do they, what ends up happening then that they would turn back to Jerusalem such that they have the Dome of the Rock there?
Well, when you go to Jerusalem, as I did back in the year 2000 when I finished up my bachelor's studies and I was able to spend an entire day on the Temple Mount, go in the Dome of the Rock, look around, take notes, actually go into the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the southern end of the Temple Mount. And I began to ask the Muslim tour guides and the authorities there, what do these structures historically, what do they symbolize? What were they built for? And I began getting a few conflicting ideas. So I started to say to myself, okay, well, let's look deeper into this. And the first structure built on the Dome of the, or excuse me, the built on the Temple Mount is actually the smaller structure at the southern end, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, that was built about the year 638.
Okay.
And looking at the sources, it mentions nothing about the night journey of Muhammad and his mysterious ascension into heaven. That's later ascribed to the Dome of the Rock, which is built about the year 700. So there's a little gap between the invention of those traditions, I think.
Huh. That's interesting. So the Al-Aqsa Mosque is the earliest Muslim construction in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount. But there's no mention there of the, and that's, would you say, 632?
About 638. That
638,
was
okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Muhammad dies 632.
Correct.
Okay. So the mosque is built there, but in the building of the mosque, there's no mention to Muhammad's night journey. What is that night journey of Muhammad?
Well, tradition holds that Gabriel awoke Muhammad and put him on a winged donkey, for lack of a better term, and they made a marvelous trip in one evening from Mecca to Jerusalem, where Muhammad met Jesus and Abraham and Moses and all the prophets and prayed with them and ascended to heaven into paradise. And that's what they hold as the reason for the construction of the Dome of the Rock.
So that's
when you look. Go ahead.
So when they built the Dome of the Rock, were they conscious? Was it consciously built with this as a was it justified because of the ascension and night journey?
Well, that's the thing that I discovered in my sources is that, number one, all the inscriptions around the Dome of the Rock do not mention anything about the night journey or the ascension. All they say is that Jesus was only a messenger. He was only a prophet. He's not the Son of God. Do not say three. Allah is only one. Jesus was only the Son of Mary. And it's very anti-Christian and very anti-Trinitarian in these inscriptions. So logically, one would have to assume that the tradition of the night journey and ascension did not exist at the time the dome was built. Otherwise, it would be pasted all over the place.
Right.
But it's not.
Wow.
And even subsequent, even other caliphs who fixed the dome and did renovations, they didn't change any inscriptions. They didn't subtract or add anything. So even as late as the year 1000, when you have Muslim authors writing, well, this was just built to be a kind of stick it to the Christians and the Jews that we're in the middle of the city. We have the dome structure and we're here now. That's kind of what the sources say.
So there's a polemical reason that the Dome of the Rock is there. I mean,
right.
That's interesting. So all those who want to kind of talk about bringing world religions together, the Dome of the Rock is evidence that at least Muslims are not ultimately interested in that kind of thing, because it's actually a preaching point against Christianity. It's anti-Trinitarian. It's anti-divinity of Jesus. Okay. That's there's something kind of funny about that.
I know.
But how is so? Once the what year is the Dome of the Rock constructed?
It's built approximately 688 to 691.
Okay, so it's still fairly early.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And when does it come to be associated? When does Jerusalem come to be associated with Muhammad's night journey?
That's a difficult thing to pinpoint in the sources, because the earliest sources we have, there's some Byzantine Christian sources that say even during the reign of Emperor Julian in the 360s, the Jews were allowed to start rebuilding the temple, which they did. But there was an earthquake, and then that didn't fall through. And then they tried to build it again during the Persian occupation, and they added a little more to the structure. And then when the Byzantine Emperor Heraclius decided to take over and start building, he started building a foundation of an eight-sided church, which ended up being the foundation that the Muslim caliph finished. He simply finished building a Jewish and Christian structure and turned it into a Muslim structure. A lot of people don't realize the architecture was pretty much copied and borrowed from the structures that were already there.
Huh.
And the Muslim authors, they talk about the supremacy of the Dome of the Rock. They talk about the politics behind it. They mention that it was built as an alternative pilgrim site to Mecca, because the leaders of Baghdad and the leaders of Damascus didn't like each other, and they were trying to compete for who could get the most pilgrims. So they tend to walk around the topic and don't definitively say, this is the ascension.
Let's come back on the other side of the break and pick it up from there, because I want to also get to the role that Jerusalem plays in Muslim apologetics today, and it's in the way they, in their own polemical arguments against Christianity in particular. My guest, Dr. Brian Bradford, author of Islamic Jerusalem, Invention of a Holy City.
Catholic Charities provides aid to 10 million people across the United States. Consider a donor-advised fund with Catholic Charities USA, an effective way to give, realizing same-year tax benefits and assuring your investment is used in accordance with Catholic social teaching. Minimal initial contribution is lower than most donor-advised funds. To learn more, go to ccusa.gives/legacy or call 1-833-323-4483.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. I want to announce that Steve Ray and I will be going on pilgrimage to the great land of Poland, August 21st to August 30th.
We're going to follow John Paul II, Maria Faustina and the Divine Mercy, and Maximilian Kolbe. We're even going to visit Auschwitz and see the place where Maximilian Kolbe gave his life in the cell there.
People can get more information at AveMariaRadio.net. And where else, Steve?
CatholicConvert.com. Click on the big pilgrimage banner or call 866-468-468. 1420.
This Easter, from 20th Century Fox and Franklin Entertainment comes Breakthrough, starring Chrissy Metz, based on a true story. When Joy Smith's son John falls through an icy Missouri lake, all hope seems lost. But a mother's belief in the power of prayer inspires her community to trust God to do the impossible.
Please God, send your Holy Spirit to save my son.
Breakthrough, rated PG, parental guidance suggested. In theaters Wednesday, April 17th. Tickets and showtimes available at BreakthroughMovie.com.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 10 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan cost goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
How serious is our responsibility to participate in furthering the common good? Very serious. According to the Catholic Catechism, participation is the voluntary and generous engagement of a person in social interchange. This obligation is inherent in the dignity of the human person. Participation calls, first of all, for us to be conscientious in exercising our responsibility in areas where we are directly involved, our families, our children's education, and our work. As far as possible, the Catechism urges, we should take an active role in public life. This leads to the Catechism's conclusion that nations which allow the broadest possible citizen participation are the nations to be lauded. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
John 14. This is Jesus in the upper room with the disciples before he's going out to his sacrifice of himself for our salvation. And Philip says to the Lord, "Show us the Father, and we'll be satisfied." Jesus looks at Philip and says, "Philip, have I been with you all this time? Don't you understand? When you see me, you're looking at the Father." In fact, only two people throughout human history have given rise to the question, not who is he, but what is he? The two people are Buddha and Jesus. Buddha's answer was, "Don't come to me, don't look to me, look to my doctrine, look to what I teach." Jesus' answer was, "Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble of heart." Jesus is explicitly claiming to be God.
And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. People have noticed that in Jerusalem you've got the presence of three major world religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And they've also noticed that the Dome of the Rock is built on the site of the Herodian Temple. And this is done really as a way of declaring Islamic supremacy over Judaism, and the inscriptions in the Dome of the Rock are also found to assert that Christianity, in its belief in the divinity of Jesus, is false. It's anti-Trinitarian. The inscriptions are as well. What we're trying to figure out is when this began, because beliefs about the Dome of the Rock, looks like many of them were invented along the way. With me is Dr. Brian Bradford. This has been an area of study for him. He's the author of Islamic Jerusalem, Invention of a Holy City. So in building over this area that was central to the Jewish faith, and by adopting and reinterpreting Christian architecture, Islam is trying to validate itself as the rightful successor in the Holy City. So this is a way of declaring supremacy over Judaism and Christianity. That's how you conclude the book. Am I getting this right?
Yes, yep, that's exactly right. The way that I tell my students or lectures is, it's as if I always put things in sports terminology for that's easy to people understand. Imagine the New York Yankees winning the World Series and then going and putting their trophy inside Comerica Park. Or inside Fenway Park, just to show that we're here, we won, we're better. And, I mean, if you go to Jerusalem, you have the Church of the Holy Sepulchre to the west. You have the Church of the Ascension on the Mount of Olives to the east. And then right in the middle, you have the Islamic structures that, in essence, are saying, we have surpassed the biblical tradition, and we are the legitimate successors to true monotheism, and we're here to stay. That's pretty much what you have to conclude when you look at all these sources.
Well, there's no doubt that historically Jerusalem is important to Judaism, the city of David, for instance, and other things. It's the place of the temple. So it's rooted in Jewish history. There's no doubt that Jerusalem plays a vital role in the history of Christianity, where the great moments of salvation history in the life of Jesus occur. What? So what's the invented history for Islam, since there are no great events in the history of Islam that occur there?
Well, the invented history that I conclude is the idea about the Muhammad flying on the winged donkey and ascending to heaven, which is an invention, because even if you look at the biography of Muhammad, which dates to about the year 830, so we're talking about 200 years after his death, when he comes back, the first report he gives, people tell him, this is absurd. A caravan takes a month to go to Syria and a month to return, and Muhammad did this in one night. And as a result, many Muslims gave up their faith because of this. And that's right from the biography of Muhammad. So even 200 years later, the Muslim sources are saying, well, this sounds like a ridiculous story. This probably didn't happen. And there's so many discrepancies within the Muslim sources themselves about when the night journey took place, where it took place from, how long it took. Did it really happen, or was it just in his mind? And looking at the Muslim sources, without any Jewish or Christian sources, from their own sources, Islam doesn't really paint a clear picture. This is really believed, even by the caliph who built the structure.
So there's no real parity here. I mean, where Jerusalem is part of the warp and woof of Judaism, and it certainly is. In terms of the redemptive events of Christianity, Jerusalem is central. There's nothing that corresponds with that at that deep level within Islam. It's just this invented story.
Yeah, just the idea of the ascension to heaven, which I argue is almost taken from the book of Enoch, which is a non-biblical text I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard of, which talks about Enoch being taken up to heaven and shown all the different levels of heaven and the angels and that sort of thing. And when you compare that side by side with Muhammad's journey and night ascension, then they're very similar.
Wow. In terms of the structure of the Dome of the Rock, what can we learn from the architecture about the purpose of the structure?
Well, the structure, number one, has to be realized it's not a mosque. It's not an actual place of prayer. It's more of a shrine. It copies the Church of the Ascension in the fact that the Church of the Ascension has what's believed to be the footprint of Jesus in the sand when he ascended into heaven. And the Dome of the Rock copies that theme and says, over here in the corner of the rock is Muhammad's footprint when he climbed the ladder and went up to heaven to meet all the prophets and the apostles before him. And there's a cave underneath called the Well of Souls, which is similar to the cave that you find that is Jesus's tomb in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And if you go inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and you count the pillars and look at the dome, and then go to the Dome of the Rock, they look like the exact same structure.
Wow.
You have the arched ways, you have the Byzantine-type dome, you have the layout of different columns and pillars, and when you compare architectural reports of pilgrims going inside the Dome of the Rock, and then later to Muslims inside the Dome of the Rock and Christians inside the Holy Sepulchre, the accounts sound like the exact same structure. And we know from the Muslim sources that there were a lot of ruined churches laying around in Jerusalem at the time, that Abd al-Malik, who built the Dome of the Rock, just used these as ready-made quarries, I guess you could say, took these stones, reshaped them, refinished them, and hired Christian artisans who happened to be in Damascus finishing the Church of John the Baptist. And he paid them to come down and use their architectural skills and just build the structure for him. So it's pretty clear and plain. It was built to show some Islamic supremacy, and it was used. Christian artisans and architecture workers just built that structure for him.
Well, How would a Muslim apologist respond to you?
Well, I had this discussion, trying to be a good Catholic on the Dome of the Rock with my Bible. That was a big mistake, for one thing, because they don't let you use that as a source for anything.
Hmm.
And they say it was God's will, and Inshallah is the term in Arabic, God wills it, that the structure there is still there. It's not Jewish. The Jewish temple is not there. It is it's higher up physically. Allah and Muhammad have sent the Quran. He is the seal of the prophets. It is the final, last, correct word for all mankind. And the proof of that is that our structure is here in the middle of Jerusalem, and yours isn't. And that's what they told me.
Yeah. Okay. So, by the same logic, if you can impose it there and then declare victory, I suppose you could bomb it and declare they've been defeated.
That's true. I had local Jewish authorities tell me that they said for 100% certainty that the Jewish community knows that the Ark of the Covenant is under the Dome of the Rock. They know it's there, but they can't get to it because of political situations.
Right.
But at the end times, they will... Either an earthquake will destroy the dome, or somebody will destroy it. The earthquake will clear away, and there will be the Ark of the Covenant, and the Jews will once again own that, and they will have their supremacy reestablished when the Ark is shown to the world.
Now, let's just for the sake of discussion here, imagine an earthquake takes place, and the Dome of the Rock is destroyed. What's the basis upon which they could rebuild it? Do they own it? In other words, how would they litigate the territory?
That's a very tricky situation because you know that right there you have the Western Wall,
right,
and then you have the Temple Mount and two Islamic structures, and you have the various gates on either side, which are still property, for lack of a better term, of the Jews, but the Muslims still control the Temple Mount. So if that actually happened politically, I tell you, I'm sure glad I'm not in the White House right now, because if that happened, it'd be a very tricky political situation to try to navigate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it'd probably create riots too all over the world.
I imagine so.
So do you foresee any resolution of the claims to that area? Right now you've got the status quo. You've got the imposed Islamic order of things there, not rooted in any serious history compared to the Jewish approach. I don't see any way of resolving this.
I don't either. To be honest, when I was there and I was doing archaeological field studies, the Muslim authorities who control that, any archaeological finds are taken and disposed of, who knows where, because the Islamic authorities really don't have any interest in pre-Islamic archaeology for that area. That's why there's so many volunteers from across the world who come over and literally sift through garbage dumps to find anything that can mention David or Solomon or the Temple of Solomon or the Temple ruins or even anything from the Roman periods that can be discovered, because basically the temple foundation up there, the Temple Mount, it looks like a alabaster football field, mm-hmm. for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. It's been whitewashed. It's been cleaned off. There's no archaeology allowed up there. It's a completely Islamic presence up there. And to prevent the Jews and to even prevent the Messiah from entering in through the Golden Gate, they built a medieval Islamic cemetery in front of the gate, which makes the Messiah unclean and you can't enter the city. So that's one more political thing that happened.
How do people get a hold of your book, Islamic Jerusalem, Invention of a Holy City?
You can find it on Amazon. And if you're in the Michigan area, I will be at a book fair Saturday, March 30th in Jackson, Michigan at Queens of the Miraculous Metal Church, and I'll be there selling my book.
All right. I may be there too, Brian. I'll see you then, I hope.
Unplanned, the true story of Abby Johnson.
I would be the youngest director in Planned Parenthood history.
She believed in a woman's right to choose.
I've had an abortion myself, so I don't have any problem with another woman making the same decision.
Until the day she saw something that changed everything.
Tiny, perfect little baby. And then it was just gone.
Now she's pulling back the curtain on the abortion industry. In theaters March 29th, visit unplanned.com for tickets. Rated R.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org. This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo.
Do you want an affordable health care option that enables you to protect your family and live your Catholic faith? CMF Curo is the Catholic health care ministry that works to bring health to the whole person, spirit, mind, and body. CMF Curo allows you to share health costs with other Christians and is more affordable than health insurance. Go to mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com. CMF Curo, healthcare fully alive.
Traveling for spring break? You don't have to miss your favorite Ave Maria program. Bookmark AveMariaRadio.net or download the Ave Maria Radio app on your smart device. You can listen to more than a dozen live or recorded Ave Maria radio shows wherever and whenever you want. On the road, in the line at the amusement park, at the beach, or in the evening after a productive day. Stay connected. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Well, thank you. Good being with you over the last hour. Let me remind you again, our upcoming trip to Poland. I'd love you to join us on that, Steve Ray and myself, looking at the lives of John Paul II, St. Faustina Kowalski. We're going to look at the life of Maximilian Kolbe, who created a huge media empire in Poland, and the life of Teresa Benedicta, St. Edith Stein. So a lot coming up on the trip to Poland. Information available at AveMariaRadio.net. Just go to the slider on the upper left corner of the front page. The Catholic Guide to Mindfulness by Susan Brinkman, that's available in the online bookstore. Check the EWTN religious catalog as well. And Deacon Harold Burke Seaver's Life of Father Augustus Tolton, that is also available in our bookstore, but in the EWTN religious catalog. And don't forget The Quest for the Islamic Jerusalem. It is a very strange feature of Islam that it's the significance of the Islamic significance of Jerusalem is basically a polemical invention. And that's what Dr. Brian Bradford points out in his book, Islamic Jerusalem, Invention of a Holy City, which, again, available in the online bookstore. Let me also let you know that we're going to be taking a look tomorrow at what's going on in West Virginia, where the Attorney General is taking an unusual approach to accusations that a local diocese knowingly employed abusers. Rather than file criminal charges, he's filing civil charges that the diocese violated consumer protection laws. We're going to talk that over tomorrow. Dr. Matthew Bunsen will be joining us. Also on other stories related to the Catholic Church. So join us tomorrow for another edition of Crest in the Afternoon. And right now, it's Catholic Answers Live coming up. Our friend Carrie Gress is there talking about Mary and toxic femininity. I'll see you tomorrow.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.